All right, folks, it looks like we got our guest on in the waiting room. So this will be an episode of Call Me Ignorant at some point, probably tomorrow, right? Or maybe even today, because I think we're all caught up on episodes. So coming to you live and in living color is Thomas 777. He was on last time talking about World War II, revisionism, and also kind of the intro, the interwar period. I don't know if you call it that, but some stuff about Hitler. But today we're going to talk about white identity. We're going to talk about the historical relationship that whites have had with other groups in, I guess, in their own countries and around the world. So let's get Thomas on in here and see what's going on. Hello, Thomas.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing? Thanks for coming on the show.
No, thanks for hosting me, man. And I'm sorry about the last minute rescheduling. This we're getting into spring now, but the winter is kind of hard on my rheumatoid stuff. I don't want to turn into one of these old guys who complains about his health incessantly and like bores the fuck out of everyone. But I don't want anyone to think of just like being like flippant or something.
Yeah. But yeah, that's totally fine.
Let me refill my water, man, and I'll be back in 2 seconds, okay?
Sure. No problem. Yeah.
Thank you, buddy.
All right, guys. If you guys want to put in any talking points into the chat or whatever, that's cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, last time Thomas was on the program, we talked about World War II, and we brought up some specific issues that he said, you know, if you want to do a full episode on one of these, that's fine. But I kind of decided to take a different route here and just kind of switch up the topic, because I am really not that informed on the history of white identity. You know, I'm certainly am pro-white. I do identify as a white identitarian, but I fell for a lot of these liberal lies over the first half of my life, or I guess way more than the first half of my life, where white doesn't really exist. I mean, what is race really? Is race a social construct? You know, white is a very new term, but all these things are just lies. They're just straight up lies. And, you know, the first immigration act in America was, you know, basically advocating for white men, free white men of good moral character to be allowed as immigrants. So, you know, that's what we're going to talk about today, I guess, because I'm new to the white thing, guys. So I don't know. We got Thomas here now. You hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, sweet, man. All right, so yeah, I was just going on a little rant about how I believed all the liberal crap for the first, you know, 30 years of my life or whatever, until I started, you know, basically realizing or being aware of my white identity and realizing that my people or our people are being persecuted, being I don't know, genocided or erased in our own societies. And I just wanted to kind of start there. When did you first become aware of your white identity? Did you ever fall into these liberal lies that I did?
I mean, I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago, yeah, which is a really nice hood. Like, it's like an awesome place to live, but it's also the town that white flight built. And I grew up in a town specifically. It was like half like Slavic, Irish, you know, some Italian folks in there, and like half Jewish. I was like this outlier, you know, like redneckish dude whose mom was like this WASP lady from LA, and my dad was like the son of like, frankly, like oaky white trash. Hmm. So, I mean, I was like a minority of one, like from jump. Okay. Hmm. And I'd spend my winters out in LA, you know, around like winter break and stuff, you know, at least back when I was young, you know, you'd get like 2 weeks off for like Christmas and New Year's and stuff, you know, as a kid in school. So then I'd go to like Los Angeles, and you know, it'd be like the same deal, just kind of like the constellation of like races would be different. But I never, my environment as a kid was never, oh, I'm the majority and, you know, things are changing for the worse because I'm going to become the minority soon. I was always the minority. Okay. And there's also, within my white identity, my family was always like very Protestant, you know, like my mom was, my grandfather, like her father was literally like this hard drinking doctor who was born in 1898, and he belonged to like a loyalist, like lodge and stuff. Okay. Mm. And like, my dad's peoples were, you know, like I said, they were like Okies and, you know, like very much you know, like Reformed Presbies and stuff. So, you know, there's that aspect of it too. You know, like I, where there definitely is a white race. There definitely is like common bonds, like civilizational, cultural, symbolic and psychological between like white peoples. But like your sect and like your ethnos like does make a difference. You know, it is like a thing.
Yeah.
But it's also too, to take it back, you know, like my folks were both born during World War II. You know, my dad ended up working for the defense establishment on, you know, as basically as a game theorist and like a war economist. You know, like my mom again, like she was like her dad was a surgeon and her mom was a German lady from Iowa. Like my maternal grandma was like my only like kind of like non-Anglophone like ancestor. But you know, and one of the reasons my folks left LA is because like the racial situation was going to hell. You know, my dad's like, he said among other things, he's like, when the Watts riots and shit were jumping off, he's like, I didn't feel safe like leaving your mom alone for like long hours during the day, especially, you know, because we were gonna be having kids and stuff. And so, you know, like my folks, like basically my folks always told me like, don't be down on somebody who's like an honorable person just because they're like black or something, but at the same time they're not like you, and just kind of like your responsibilities to like your family. And you know, like they basically conveyed the correct ideas without like, you know, being like too political about it and stuff. I mean, my dad doesn't like share my views, but my dad's like not remotely liberal, or like my dad never, if I come home telling him crazy stuff, like, oh, I learned in school today, Dad, that like the white man's really bad and like, you know, we need more immigration. He would've been like, what the fuck is the matter with you? And like pulled me out of school that day.
Awesome. Wow.
This was also, but in Chicago too, people like don't think that way really. Like, you'll find like fucked up liberals and stuff from like Wicker Park. Most of them are like transplants. And like, yeah, there was definitely like a lot of bullshit relating to like kind of like Zionist conceits and stuff. Just kind of like in the local culture where I grew up. But it's like people in Chicago, like it's not weird for people like kind of casually say the N-word. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying like, it's not weird. Like, you still have, like, hoods that are 100% Mexican, like, 100% Ukrainian, like, 100% black. You know, like, it's not, like, Irvine Welsh said that Chicago reminded him of, like, Belfast in that way. Because there's, like, a racial geography. I was saying Belfast, it's sectarian. But people have this idea that who aren't from here or don't visit here because of what they see on the news or stuff. And they think, like, we're, like, Berkeley, but, like, bodies also get dropped. It's, like, Chicago is, like, probably the most, like, unliberal big city in this country.
Wow.
Okay. So, I mean, there's that too. It's not like I was going to school and people were, I mean, public school teachers are fucking idiots. So, I mean, like I had like all kinds of fucked up teachers, but nobody was saying like, you know, like you enslave black people or like bullshit like that. Like I said, there was some bad stuff like about, you know, like Zionist bullshit and like how like, oh, Israel's under siege and like, you know, the Holocaust. And, but I mean, that's because, I grew up basically like just east of Skokie. Skokie's like ground zero for like, you know, Jewish Chicago, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when the Blues Brothers was the Illinois Nazis. Yep. And shit. Okay, yeah. Yep. But that's, so I mean, I was always conspicuous, but it wasn't, you know, great. This was a long time ago now, because like I'm freaking pushing 50 years old, but it's also, it just like isn't like that here. So, look, I realize I'm rambling, but no, I didn't have this like red pill moment that I guess most people or a lot of people have. Yeah. Where it's like, I thought that what the regime was saying was true, and then one day I realized it was telling me twisted things. Mm. Like I never identified with like public authority, like personally. I was never a majority on the ground where I lived, like not even close. I never, you know, I never believed what it was telling me about World War II and stuff. I mean, they don't do a constellation of factors, but mostly it's because mostly it's because of my parents, who again, like, weren't highly political people, but they were definitely, you know, kind of like traditional Americans in a basic sense. And it's also because, you know, like I said, I was surrounded by immigrants and non-white people like all the time, you know, like, and it's not, I didn't have some like ill will towards them, but I, you know, unless they were assholes or something, but it's like, it was also very clear to me even as a little kid, like, these people are not like me and vice versa. Mm. You know, so there wasn't some kind of like moral or emotional or cognitive like leap I had to take, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, my red pill experience. It basically happened over a 2 or 3 year period from living in DC and running this show every day. And I just, what I saw in people, you know, pointed me to different, different materials. And I just saw kind of that happened to me at a very late age. And I definitely makes me look at my, you know, my life when I was a liberal, just seeing that I just drank the Kool-Aid, that public school, Detroit area Kool-Aid. But it's interesting how Detroit in a way is the same, not the same as Chicago, but there's hints of that in Detroit as well, where it's, there's ethnic neighborhoods. And, you know, growing up, there wasn't this big, like, oh, the N word. It was like, yeah, I mean, that's just a word and people call each other it. I'll call my friends it. They called me that, you know, it's like, and black people say it, you know, it's just a word, you know? So there was hints of that. So you mentioned a second ago that you and your father didn't share this. He doesn't share your views. Can you just share? Because I mean, I've watched a lot of your, I've read some of your Substacks, and I've kind of pieced together through your tweets and through some of your interviews over the last couple of years of what you're, you know, what I think you're about. But why don't you just share, when you say your views regarding, I guess, race, what would those be?
Well, I mean, my dad's a guy, my dad's like George Kennan. I mean, like, George Kennan's like one of his heroes, and that's basically how he like comes out of the world, okay? You know, my dad's like an old stock, you know, like white prod, and, you know, he's got very clear ideas on what he thinks America's mission is and what it is not. I mean, me, I don't have some like super, super hard like take on race. But I do identify with the Third Reich a lot, not because I'm like somebody who thinks you can like necromance like old regimes, or because like I'm some kind of like historical nostalgic. But, you know, it's kind of prime symbols and the kind of cycle and its psychological impactfulness that derive from something I think is perennial and like powerful. Okay, and I take that very seriously. You know, I look at race as the kind of corporeal manifestation, you know, of a cultural idea, and of an imperative and a will to bring into being, you know, what something is truly, you know, in this case we're talking about race, we're talking about what the Germans would call Menschen material. You know, what a people values, like how they view themselves, you know, like what their kind of concept of the world around them is and their role in it. That's like the essence of the thing we're talking about. Like the form is like the race that like develops, you know, like congruence with that thing, you know. I mean basically like Martin Heidegger, like Julius Evola are probably, and Mircea Eliade, that's probably my trifecta of like how I view race. You know, like I don't spend a lot of time writing about race because from like some policy-based perspective where I'm like, oh, these people commit more crimes and these people have higher IQs. But I'm not saying anything wrong with like that kind of research. Yeah. And I'm not saying like it's stupid to, you know, deep dive into that stuff where it's like significant to, you know, something that's on the table, but it's not really like what I'm up on, you know, like I look at things in a more conceptual, from a more conceptual perspective, and like why like race is important like on its own terms, not like as a political quantity, or and not, you know, like sociologically, like what its implications are for, you know, certain sorts of behaviors or certain sorts of outcomes. Okay, so now the way my dad views that kind of stuff is, you know, like I said, he's like a game theorist and an economist. And some of what he does is like very much in my wheelhouse. You know, I love game theory. I minored in econ in college, okay? But my dad looks at me as this kind of like weird artsy guy who's into like rock and roll and like weird shit and like has some problems. Like not only like punitively, but what I'm talking about is, you know, my struggles in the past with, you know, like heroin and stuff. And I mean, he's even actually said like, you know, his kind of euphemism when he's, you know, for like what he thinks are like far out people, he calls them like creative people. He's like, well, creative people didn't have problems with drugs and alcohol, or like, you know. And I'm like, so that's kind of his jive, you know. Like if you, my dad's he and I are probably more like one another than like any other, like than either of us is like anybody else. but there definitely are like profound like differences. So, you know, if I started dropping like Julius Evelyn or C. Eliade on him, he'd think that I was he'd view it as like kind of like crazy, kind of like voodoo spirituality kind of shit. Huh. And he'd tune out. Which is okay. Fine. I mean, you know, everybody's he's got conceptual biases owing to his own upbringing and generation, and that's totally fine. But he's also like a massively left brain dominant kind of person, you know, like his like concrete particulars and economic variables and things of this nature, and what inputs that translate to tangible phenomenon, you know, that can literally be touched or counted. Like that is sort of his world. So, yeah. But I love my dad more than anybody. I'm not saying anything bad about him. But yeah, that's basically the shot.
Yeah, interesting. And I listened to a lot of people that reference those writers that you just said, but I've actually never read any books by Evelyn Heidegger. Was the last one Eliade?
Yeah, Mircea Eliade. He was an Orthodox theologian, and he taught at the University of Chicago, and it came out in the 70s. When there was a big like witch hunt underway for people who served in the Third Reich in various capacities, it turned out Eliade had been in the Romanian Iron Guard, and he was involved. The degree to which he was involved in direct action kinds of activity is somewhat murky, but there was this people were trying to get him indicted, by the Department of Justice. You know, people were trying to get him fired, and Leo Strauss, to his credit, who was a weird guy. I mean, aside from like his Zionism and his other things that don't track with us, but apparently Strauss did have some degree of personal loyalty, because he really went to bat for Mircea Eliade and said like, whatever this guy did during the war, like that's over with now. Like he's my friend. Like basically like stop fucking with him, which is interesting. I've got nothing at all nice to say about Leo Strauss. But I can say that, I guess, but, and Eliade, you know, again, too, I'm a Reformed presby. So, I mean, obviously, like, Christian Orthodoxy, I find it very interesting, but it's definitely not, you know, like my confessional heritage. But Eliade's, he's kind of, the stuff he deals in, is, you don't need to be Orthodox to understand what he's talking about. And actually, he wrote for kind of like a general Christian audience. And hit the convergence between, you know, kind of like Christian metaphysics, or like religious metaphysics generally, and the political, and what like how those things index with one another and how they should sort of relate in conceptual terms. You know, he wrote some very important stuff on that. Okay. And not enough people pay attention to him. Orthodox guys do, but people outside of that wheelhouse are going like, that's, you know, what do I want to read that for? Like it's, you know, but I highly recommend him. Wow. And if it was a little bit, some of his stuff does kind of delve into, you know, like Roman mysticism almost. But the stuff that he wrote about what I think of as kind of pure politics and the relationship between like culture and politics as a complete sort of quantity, that's really important, as well as defining what actually kind of like the struggle is between like the right and the left. Like De Maistre is another guy who I think describe that in the most complete terms. So that's what I derive from both of them. Heidegger's a little more complicated, and Heidegger's enjoying something of a resurgence now, or a renaissance, because he wrote so much about human consciousness and I like defining what consciousness is. And there's a lot being written about AI now, a lot of which is really fucking stupid, but some of which is really compelling stuff. And so Heidegger, like you can't get away from Heidegger. First of all, Heidegger, I think he was about the most important, he understood Aristotle more than any other like modern philosopher, I believe. So you can't get away from him for that reason. And describing like the nature of consciousness and you know how that impacts technology and vice versa, and like man leading a life that truly is like, you know, defined by the technology he uses, everything from, you know, prosaic stuff, you know, like consumer electronic stuff, you know, like his smartphone, you know, to the way he organizes his life according to like how he's paid and things like this. Like it, it's important stuff. And the way that impacts politics might seem kind of abstract on the surface, but it's very much like a defining kind of like characteristic of like modern living. And they're going to talk about politics in the modern state, like you've got to deal with that stuff. So that's a short answer.
Wow. Yeah. I definitely, take some notes over here on I got to read more. I spend too much time podcasting and not enough time reading, it looks like. So, you know, I want to just get into, just a little bit of the differentiation that you brought up earlier between, and I know that you weren't saying that this is necessarily a bad thing, but you know, there's people that there seems like their life's work is things like, crime statistics or, you know, some sort of statistic, or like, you know, this is the argument for why a certain people either shouldn't be allowed here or should be viewed in a certain way, and how you kind of don't, I don't know if I'm mischaracterizing what you're saying, but how you, that's not really what you're about when it comes to race, but differentiating that type of worldview and what you, or I guess it might not even be worldview. It might be just how someone chooses to describe or research the different races. So what do you see as potentially problematic, or why you don't choose to spend your time that way?
I mean, I'm basically interested in historical phenomena and how that impacts the present, both the present in epochal terms as well as in like day-to-day terms. But there's also, as people, like collectively, like at the level of culture, became disengaged from metaphysics or anything truly religious, you know, certain modalities of thought became not just dominant, but they crowded out all other possible kind of conceptual vistas. And Wolfgang Smith wrote a lot about this. So even people nominally on the right, you know, they're afflicted by this. I even go as far as to say, like, they're particularly afflicted by this. So all too often when people write about race, it's from this kind of like rationalist utilitarian perspective, like race might not be very important, but oh, these people commit crimes, or, you know, categorically these people don't assimilate well, or, you know, this population is kind of neutral, but we should have smarter people like these people over here, because the more smart people we have, then like the better outcomes we have at scale. I don't think those kinds of things are particularly important.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like obviously don't want like fucked up people who like commit crimes all day or who like can't adapt to modern life, like in your living space. But that's kind of like a different question. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why like ethnos is important is not because we're a bunch of people who agree not to commit crimes together. You know, like it's like what mitigates like really the only way man can like come to terms with death and oblivion, as well as derive meaning from life, like it basically is like his metric is historical time. Okay. There's people who are like highly religious, particularly some Christian sects who would disagree with me and say like, no, you know, it's salvation through Christ, you know, and you're looking at it the wrong way. I'm not even going to fuck with that. Okay. Suffice to say, I don't believe that. But when you rip away historical time, you're creating a pointless society. Okay, as well as, you know, essentially preventing people from like leading a fulfilling life in terms of, you know, their ability to kind of like engage with the past and the future as well as the present, and including a future that they won't even live to see, because in some basic sense, you know, they're going to make up that like pastiche of information and collective memory that informs future generations, like within this own kind of like conceptual community of conceptual agreement. Okay. Like that's a big part of like what your race is. Mm. It's not, we don't want our car getting broken into, so those people can't live here. Yeah. You know, like I said, like I'm not suggesting like people shouldn't like police their own fucking borders or something, like that goes without saying, but that's like a totally different thing, you know, and it's not like why race is important. Mm. But people adjust, sometimes they don't even realize they're doing it. People like adjust their own kind of conceptual models to kind of conform to like a liberal paradigm. I mean, capital L liberalism, like a rationalist like paradigm.
Yeah.
You know, because it's unseemly to not do that. like even if you're among people who aren't, you know, like woke type people or I mean, it's, or like whatever, it's like unseemly to talk about things that would seem to touch a concern like religious concerns or like metaphysical stuff and things like that. It's like, oh, we don't talk that way anymore, or oh, maybe that's true, but you know, that's the kind of stuff like, you know, it's not really appropriate to talk about. You know, like I thought about this a lot. Like I think, you know, like William Pierce made the point that talking about race and deep capacities, like, you know, in the contemporary days, I mean, he's talking in the 90s, but the same goes for today. It's almost like the way people used to feel about like talking about sex. Like, no, you shouldn't be talking about that. Like, and there's a lot of that with what I'm talking about too. Okay. I mean, I'm talking about race as well. Pierce was talking about it in a bit of a different capacity, but you know, it's like stuff people should kind of not discuss publicly, like sex, people talk about all the time, but then stuff that, you know, really kind of like is the basis of our communitarian life, as well as kind of like being a fully realized human. It's like, oh, we don't talk about that. Like that's upsetting, or like that's religion or something like it. And that's bad. It's, they can't tell you why it's bad. It's just like axiomatically bad for some kind of like ambiguous reason. Mm. So that's basically what I mean by that. Wow. And again, I'm not trying to discourage people from like whatever. If there's like some dude watching this who's like writing a PhD thesis on race and IQ, that's great. I'm not saying that's like stupid or like bad or something. It's just not what I'm talking about. Something totally different. And with some people, they conflate one with the other, and that's misguided.
And a lot of this stuff I'm not, you know, a true intellectual or anything like that. I love consuming content, and I'm not as well versed as you know, presenting my arguments. I just kind of like fly off instinct a lot. But something deep down knows I already agree with you, because I mean, I don't really focus on the crime statistics and all that stuff. Cause it's, to me, it's, you know, if let's say we import a bunch of people that aren't white, and, but they have skyrocketing high IQs. They, you know, they improve society in materially measurable ways. They would still not be white. And it's like they would, and I would still be different from them, even if we're the same in these measurable ways. We're not the same in very easily observable ways, just how we look, how we structure our lives. And it seems like that is a more important thing. It's, I don't mean the us and us versus them distinction necessarily, because I don't, you know, I'm not against them in that way, but there is an us and there's a them, and I am not one of them and they are not one of us. And regardless, even if I commit more crime, even if they commit less than me or whatever, it just, they are not, we are not the same in the racial way.
No, I 100%. But it's also something, there's this weird discourse. I mean, I understand how and why it was emergent. But from the mid 60s until about the late 90s, there was like this ridiculous uptick in like violence, and nobody can explain why. Like, I think about this a lot because like that's when I was a kid and a young person, and it was like all around us. And then suddenly like it just stopped. I mean, the way at scale, the way humans behave socially is strange. I think about that a lot. But in any event, like crime and like the implications of antisocial behavior at scale, that took on an outsized sort of significance in discussion on race. Because again, it's something people, you're like allowed to talk about that, at least in euphemistic ways. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that don't really get what we're talking about, like writ large. They just don't like get what we're up on conceptually. Mm. But also, even some of those that do, at least partially, you know, they glom on to the kind of crime and like life outcome thing and IQ thing, because that's something that still like remains like acceptable, like to raise in kind of normie discourse.
Right.
You know, and,
yeah. Cause people are convinced, this is all in air quotes, people are convinced by studies and statistics and pragmatism, and people don't think about the you know, capital L liberal is probably the right way to describe it in a rational post enlightenment sense. That's what convinces people.
Yeah. It's something of a false metric. And again, like I'm not, obviously like the decay of American cities, that was like very deliberate. okay? Mm. And like there's obviously an aspect of like racial warfare to that against us. People should never like run from that or like pretend that that's not happening. But if you, but acting like, you know, resolving that is cement in itself, you know, like one of the big, I'm fascinated by the Soviet Union's internal narratives, particularly like post Khrushchev, you know, like into like the 1980s and like the Brezhnev era and beyond. And for all kinds of reasons, but I mean, and I think you can tell something about the state of like our regime from that kind of comparative analysis. But so when the Soviets became totally fixated on in like the 70s was, oh, we have no crime here. And, you know, America and West Germany and, you know, the United Kingdom, they're like full of crime and all this bullshit, which was true. And the Soviet Union, it didn't really have street crime, but I mean, it was a fucking hellhole. You know, like I don't want to live in the crime free Soviet Union. Do you? representing the countervailing metric or whatever, to like assail what is purportedly, you know, the inassailable, you know, kind of like end game of history norm. I mean, that's like on all sides of the political spectrum, that's what people kind of became insinuated into. And I think, like I said, I think it's almost subconscious, but
yeah,
but we got to, you know, but that's one of the things, I mean, such that I do engage on subjects of, you know, a practical nature, like what should people be doing? You know, the kind of what I emphasize over and over again is don't allow your kind of conceptual horizon to be structured, you know, by parameters put forth by like regime authority or even by people who like aren't deliberately trying to sabotage, you know, your own kind of intellectual development, but who just, you know, don't know any better. You know, like people need to stop thinking within these like arbitrary parameters.
Yeah.
You know, about what is possible, or I mean, let alone like what is, you know, a social or ethical good. But yeah, I realize that gets kind of abstract. But yeah, that's basically my joke, man.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, what you know, just a little about the history. I mean, you said a second ago, and I completely agree that there's this this urban, you know, there's this warfare against whites, especially in the cities in a certain time period. I guess it would maybe be the 50s through the 70s or something like that. There's the white flight. There's that whole deal. Why do you think? I guess a 2-part question. Why do you think that was done against whites, and who were the primary people doing it?
In the North, it was to break the back of Catholic political power, as well as to ethnically cleanse the parish communities that sustained that power. Okay, the look at that Father Coughlin, you know, the radio priest who was the arch nemesis of you know, the Roosevelt administration. Mm-hmm. He was more popular than Walter Winchell. Like, he was the most popular media personality of the time. You know, he was this right-wing Catholic.
Wow.
And the way the Hays Code, you know, the Hays Code was basically got passed or got adopted because Coughlin and, you know, a quorum of very powerful Catholic media people, I mean, people in Catholic media, I don't mean like media people who are Catholic, you know, they essentially were able to mobilize, you know, millions of parishioners to boycott Hollywood. Hmm. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
You know, and these political machines in the cities, including Chicago, you know, they became kingmakers, man. And, what better opportunity. And World War II is in part like a war against the Catholic Church too. Okay, so like after World War II, you know, it's how like from the perspective of you know, these progressives and these radical Jewish elements, just speaking honestly, mm-hmm. you know, how do we break these parish communities? Well, you know, oh, they're racist. You know, that's, we're going to extrapolate basically this kind of neo-reconstruction means or method, you know, that we're forcing through the courts now, you know, to break the back of, you know, restrictive covenants and selective allocation and housing. You know, we're just going to extrapolate that to the north. Like, oh, you're white and you're discriminating against black people. Like, it doesn't matter if, like, the community in question is, like, a bunch of Lithuanians who don't even speak English. Like, we're going to pretend, like, you're part of, like, the white people who are oppressing us. Or not us. There was, like, nearly a black person, like, was involved in this effort. It was a bunch of commies and – it was a bunch of white commies and Jews. But but that was – it was piggybacked on, like, the whole desegregation effort. That's why it happened in the north. And that's – the left always overreaches and radicals always overreach. So, like, what they did, though, by doing that, they created the Wallace Coalition, which was, you know, Southern whites, you know, like, redneckish kind of people voting on the same ticket as, like, Northern Catholics, you know, who are Irish, Polish, Italian, what have you. You know, that was the Wallace Coalition, which then Nixon was able to capture, which became the silent majority, which became the Reagan Coalition, which is now MAGA. That's what MAGA is. And that's one of the reasons why the regime was, like, utterly berserk about Trump. Wow. Like, it doesn't make any sense, like, just on its face. If you look at Trump, Trump's, like, some reality TV, like, personality. Like, they go utterly berserk about him because, you know, they – it's the demographic he represents, and they don't – they're not competent, so they don't know how to, like, finesse that in a way that, you know, they can kind of, like, defang its momentum while granting that voting bloc, like, you know, the appearance of a concession, but not really. But that's, I mean, that's why. And it, but that's also why that effort fell apart. Like, I mean, part of the damage was done on the one hand, but also, like, as like, the '70s became the '80s, like, the courts just stopped. They stopped being willing to, like, entertain that fiction, you know, that, like, you know, however, you know, these kinds of NGOs were, like, going around, you know, looking for people to certify as, you know, like, a plaintiff's class to, you know, to bring these, like, civil rights lawsuits, and then claiming that because some old Polish people, like, aren't renting to, like, black people, like, on the West Side, like, it's part of some legacy of white racism. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I mean, like, everything else aside, like, everything that's fucked up about that aside, just on its face, it, like, doesn't track. Like, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make any sense in historical terms, even within its own kind of conceptually biased parameters. But, wow. I mean, that's why. But it's also, it's important to, the regime attacks everything, not itself. And if you look at, I don't know, like, where you're going to upload this to. Like, I don't want to say things that are going to get your content stricken or something. But there's a stanza in Mein Kampf, which otherwise is not a particularly worthwhile book, because it's just, it was like an election year screed, basically trying to convey to Weimar voters, like, why they should vote for the party. Like, it's not some people on the left act like it's the Necronomicon, and, like, people on the right who don't read either, like, act like it's some, like perennial, it's like some marvelous philosophical text or something. It's neither of those things. But Hitler made the point in it that he said, if the communists win, you know, if they win in Europe, and, you know, they conquer, like, the world island, you know, from the Atlantic to Vladivostok, and, you know, from there just kind of, like, expand outward like some kind of lamprey, like, wrapping its tentacles around the earth. He's like, what the ultimate communized future is it's this kind of human population, like, literally, like, deteriorated by, you know, breeding down and race mixing, but also just, you know, people who, like, who over time, like, have been robbed of intellect and culture. So you're giving up to the planet of, like, no race, of no culture by anybody, you know, just kind of like people, like, living as, like, animals, but animals with, like, the capacity for, like, you know, some kind of abstract thought, but really only as it relates to this kind of, like, petty and mundane, like, labor they're insinuated into. You know, that's, like, that really is, like, a, like, nightmarish. But that's basically not according to, like, master plan or something of guys, like, rubbing their hands together and devising schemes. But that's basically the end game of what Bolshevism was. That's basically the end game of taking to its kind of logical conclusion you know, like regime social engineering is. And it's like a war on everybody, not itself, like not just white people. Like they want non-white people to be these like deteriorated kind of like hollowed out vessels too. That's not to say you should like be as concerned about them as you are your own people, but it's important to keep in mind. You know, like the regime wants to annihilate Russia, just like it wants to annihilate Europe, just like it wants to annihilate Dar al-Islam. You know, like this is not an accident or some like arbitrary like constellation of peoples identified as enemy. And if you look at the way the occupation of Europe has proceeded since 1945, and which continues to this day, it's a social engineering regime. Okay, 100%. That's like why it's there. You know, incidentally, America's war against Russia with Ukraine as a proxy has everything to do with continuing that regime in Europe. But it's not a normal occupation. You know, it's not just because like, well, you know, oh, America's got to keep these, you know, like European, like nationalist instincts in check for the interest of stability. Like that doesn't make sense anyway. But even if that was sort of, you know, the people who are the architects of policy believe that, it's like, well, then why are they saying we've got to like push a gay marriage in Ireland? Like, why are they saying that we've got to like make Germany less white? Like, why are they saying like we've got to educate school kids about, you know, their heritage of militarism in Germany and how this culminated in the murder of Jewish people, and this can never be allowed to happen again. Like, why would that even be within your contemplation? You know, and people can respond like, oh, because those things happened. It's like, did they, you know, it's like, is that something that attends military occupation ordinarily? Some kind of bizarre, like socially engineered, like curriculum, you know, to try and like alter the way people view themselves and their culture. Like that's not what you do, I mean, under normal conditions, like not remotely. So, yeah, that's, I mean, I realized there was a lot there, but yeah.
Oh, man, that was awesome. Yeah, that was, and it's just like such a interesting historical through line, and especially what you were saying, and it just kind of a light bulb went off in my brain when you were talking about how the, for the Catholics at the beginning of the Catholics 100 years ago or so, basically there's a political lineage that's traced all the way to MAGA. And this is basically what you would call correct me if I'm wrong, the non-liberal political white vote over a 100 year period. Because that's one thing that I really fell for around the time of Trump, is they would say, you know, Trump's not a racist or whatever. Trump isn't dog whistling, and he doesn't just represent white people. I mean, but he does represent that lineage, and he kind of always did as a politician. And that's not a bad thing. He was kind of signaling in a way to that group of whites. And
exactly. No, Trump's self-consciously aware of that. And that's one of the reasons Trump's not a sophisticated, he's not a sophisticated guy politically, like in the sense of like what we're talking about. I'm not saying I'm so sophisticated, but you know what I mean is like, he's not thinking about politics in like global terms, or he doesn't have like some deep theory of like history or something, but he very much understands, you know, kind of the electoral breakdown of America and the sociological implications therein, at least kind of like in the present. And that's one of the reasons why he reached out to Nixon a few times during the 80s. Hmm. And it's really interesting to read their correspondence. But, and I mean, so obviously, you know, the kind of what people took away from that in sort of like regime media were, oh, Trump's long been plotting this, you know, kind of White House run. Like, yeah, he has, but he reached out to Nixon for a reason. And the parallels between their two, like Trump's, what it means about Trump, this comeback he has staged is nothing short of incredible. I did not think it was possible. And there's nothing comparable other than Nixon's comeback, in my opinion, in 68. Mm. But the point being, Trump's very aware that, you know, like the MAGA vote is, you know, like the silent majority, like white vote, like dispossessed white vote. Okay. And yeah, it's like if non-white people like vote that way too, that's fine. But if he's pretending like this is just for the, you know, for the sake of an alibi, like, oh, this is some like non-racial message. Like, yeah, that's not true. But,
wow. Wow. Yeah. So it's always just been right there. And I've seen you, you've been tweeting about this dynamic with Trump lately. And so when you say his comeback, do you mean kind of post 2020 or do you mean his entire arc?
No, I mean, post 2020. And I thought even a year ago.
Yeah.
Like I knew Biden was done because like if they weren't going to like swap him out for a man who could actually carry the role, like it was like they would have lost like any vestige of legitimacy they had. So I figured either they were going to swap out Biden for a man who they can actually, you know, take out in public who's not going to fuck it up, or they were going to I mean, I knew DeSantis wasn't going anywhere. I mean, that was clear from jump. But I thought that Trump was basically dead in the water. But his, the moment, part of it was this malicious prosecution effort against him. I mean, I think that I mean, some of it's Trump thrives on negativity, would agree. But also, like, they made a martyr of him. And that was kind of a shot in the arm. But those things in and of themselves, like, wouldn't be enough to... to really drive the momentum for the kind of comeback that he staged. You know, like Trump seems positively energized now and the things are definitely going his way. And I mean, I think it's going to be a different version of Trump. I think Trump's going to be the president again. And I think it's going to be a different version of him. I think people are going to be somewhat disappointed in some ways. I think in other ways, they're going to be very kind of animated. But he's the process of him like making peace with the deep state has been underway for the last couple of years. Okay. Mm. And what that means for us, I don't think a whole hell of a lot, like positive or negative. I don't think it represents any like massive game changer in like direct policy terms. But there's definitely things to be built on from there. And, you know, basically like the white man saying like, look, we're 70 million strong. And if you fuckers try and like other us, that's not going to happen, you know, and you need us. We don't need you fuckers, which is absolutely true. You know, like it's us keeping this fucking mess going, you know, not the people who like are parasitically like attached to us, you know, not this do nothing regime that, you know, basically can only like live literally like based on our like labor and brain power. I mean, like when we need these people, like we need these people, like I need a malignant tumor in my brain, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, dude, I mean, it's the very the logistics, the things that sustain a society. It truly is whites doing it. That's just a fact. I mean, and many people that are non-white recognize this as well. The smart ones do. And that's interesting to hear you say, I've been actually been saying kind of a similar thing on my streams lately where it's basically the, what Trump symbolizes. I mean, it's who Trump is a big part of why I think whites should support Trump, but it's the movement that he symbolizes. And to be honest, I haven't really traced the political lineage of it today. I didn't know so many of those things that you said a couple minutes ago, but it's just the movement he represents and what he symbolizes is why to support
That's why Trump's important. Like, it doesn't matter if I or anybody else, like sometimes people get on my ass saying like, oh, why are you trashing Trump? It doesn't matter like what I think of Trump or anybody else, like as a guy. Like I actually do kind of like Trump. I don't think I'm terribly hard. I don't think I'm terribly punitive in my like takes on him. Mm. But even if Trump is like a total asshole, or even if like people think he is, or if we're just like a big phony, like that doesn't matter. It's exactly what you said. It's what he represents, and it's the mobilization of like a discreetly like white kind of like plurality like around him that is like self-conscious. Trying to like insinuate like their politics into the presidential regime, like that. Mm-hmm. 100%. That's what it is what you said.
Wow. You know, just to go back to a couple other things before we wrap up our time here. You know, I saw a debate between Jared Taylor and E. Michael Jones a couple years ago on race, and it was an interesting interview. I welcome everyone to listen to that because it kind of seemed like they were in a way talking past each other. And, you know, E. Michael Jones. I think he basically believes race is a social construct, and Jared Taylor's basically his life's work is based. He's a white advocate, a lifelong white advocate. And you brought up something earlier that was interesting. You said something about non-English speaking Lithuanians basically being regarded as white people by the powers trying to use them. So in that respect, it is true that they were maybe socially constructed to be white for political opportunism at the time, but also the race of white people biologically just does exist. So it seems that both men are right in a way. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
The problem with Jones is that Jones is kind of an obtuse guy. Like, I like Jones. Like, I don't know the dude, but I like a lot of his content, and I think he's a brilliant guy. But he goes too far to make a point. I believe that's what he's doing. I think he's deliberately being obtuse to like make a point. There is a white race. Okay, biologically, yeah. But also like historically, there is. But that doesn't somehow supersede ethnicity. And there's an added layer in America, because despite what people say, America was not like an immigrant society.
Yeah.
And there weren't like substantial numbers of immigrants here till the 20th century. Like the later years of the Grant administration onward, see, like last third of the 19th century onward, you had like appreciable immigration here. Nothing like today's standards, but shorthand in America, when we say white, we mean somebody like me. We mean like Anglophone, like Protestant, generally like non-high church Protestant.
Yep.
Like founding stock or adjacent.
Yep.
We don't mean like everybody from like Ireland of Letty Vostok, you know, but that does not mean that like there's not like a white race, or that like, you know, there's not like common sources, you know, conceptually, culturally, like theologically of like value that, you know, like white peoples like draw upon in common, you know, to like sort of like structure the world around them. You know, so no, I'm not one of these guys who's like, oh, there is no white race. There's only discrete ethnicities therein. But there's also another layer because, thankfully, I think America's basically gotten beyond like the sectarian divide, which was still a thing until the 1950s. You know, but in America, like your confessional heritage is kind of your ethnicity. You know, I think so. So there's that too, you know, like you're Catholic, Orthodox, or Prod, you know, you're kind of on your own like cultural tip, you know. So it's like all those things, but yeah, it's as obtuse for Jones to say like there's no white race as it is for guys to claim that like, you know, biology is like everything. Like it's
absolutely. And I've echoed the same for years, like that. If you're there's people that claim that genetics is the entire thing. I think that's ridiculous. But it's also to say that it's none of it is also ridiculous. It's
100%.
And we're also people are moving across time. So it's like everything is being affected and affecting other things at all times. And it's not even a pie chart, because a pie chart is a snapshot and that you're looking at one time. But then during the time of looking at that pie chart, these factors are affecting each other. So it's very hard to trace, because we want a simple, you know, this or that type of deal. So E. Michael Jones was on the show about 5 years ago. And I think obtuse is a good way of saying it. I knew nothing at the time. I wish I was a little bit more farther down.
No, he's a good dude. But, I actually have met Jared Taylor a bunch of times. I don't think he likes me very much.
Really?
Yeah. But he's been, just because it's just, I go out of my way to be nice to Taylor as well as all of his peoples, because they've been very cool to my friend Ace and some of the younger guys, and I want to see them do well.
Yep.
But it's, you know, people like Jared Taylor generally don't like me very much, and that's fine. Okay. But he's a smart dude, and like he's definitely like a thoughtful guy. Like I think Taylor would be Taylor's the kind of the way progressives, capital P progressives, used to think is kind of like Taylor's jive, I believe, you know. And he very much looks at race from like a Francis Galton kind of like eugenics perspective. And it wasn't a great from like a George Bernard Shaw kind of perspective. He's an interesting guy, but that's kind of his tip. And I don't think he's religious at all. Like, he wouldn't go out to say that, but I don't, that's what I've gleaned, man. And like, I've been following him for a minute, but yeah, that's my take on him.
Yeah. I don't think in all my times listening to him, I've really ever heard him mention religion at all.
His parents were some kind of missionaries. That's why he's so, you know, he grew up in Japan for a time. And I've known his kids. I mean, I'm not trying to speculate on Taylor's like early life or something, but I know his kids are like parents who were like very committed to things like that. They tend to go one of two ways. Either they follow in their footsteps or they very much kind of like revolt against that in some way. Maybe that's his job. I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, yeah, before we get out of here, you know, I have this on my viewing list that I'm going to watch later, but I saw that you did, you did like a debate the other day between you and, like a black Hebrew Israelite type guy on the kill stream, but, I haven't watched it yet, so I can't really give my thoughts, but what were you guys discussing and
Ethan is a great dude. Ethan Ralph. He's a good dude, man. Yeah. Like he's always been a very good friend of me. That black Israelite guy, I guess he's, and like Ethan's like, Ethan kind of does like the Hell's version of Hollywood Squares, you know, in a way. I mean, and like that guy, I guess, I don't know how the hell you need to know each other, but he's always on deck to, you know, I guess kind of, present the less than reasonable, like black man's perspective. And I was on before with him, and I guess people liked it a lot, like kind of the back and forth. So Ethan asked if I'd do it again, and I'm like, yeah, sure. And people seem to really like that clip. So yeah, it's I like one on the kill stream, man. Like I know some people think that Ethan's they think that his content's a bit like over the top and stuff. I guess it's not for everybody, but he's always been very cool to me, man. And I always have fun. Like, I wouldn't want to do it every day, but
yeah, seems taxing.
But it's, I have fun, man, with that kind of stuff. And, like I said, a bunch of people told me that they really liked that, segment. So that makes me happy.
What was actually discussed? I mean, was there a, not in the, I know in the kill stream, there's not really, you know, like a resolution.
Well, I mean, like watch it. Watch it. I mean, it's better if you're surprised.
Okay. All right. That's great, man. Well, thank you so much for the history lesson. I know we all learned a ton today. Last question. I didn't get to this last time. What kind of music do you like? What kind of music are you into? I mean, you seem like you have the kind of the, you know, the punk background in a way. I don't know if you would ascribe to that.
I mean, like a lot of people think I'm like this huge heavy metal guy or something. Mm. I mean, don't get me wrong. Probably like my favorite band of all time is Judas Priest. Mm-hmm. But I love Elvis. I love Johnny Thunders. Lately I've been listening to getting kind of back to my prog roots. I've been listening to a lot of Hawkwind. The fellas turned me on to his band Black Magic SS, which is pretty dope. But I basically, you know, Elvis, Johnny Thunders, New Wave of British Heavy Metal, stuff like Priest and Grim Reaper. I played classical music for like 12 years. So, I mean, I listened to, I love Holsch, I love Berlioz, I love Tchaikovsky, I love Mozart, obviously I love Beethoven. So it's kind of like classical when I'm at home. Classical, like some dungeon synth, some proggy stuff. When I'm out and about, it's usually Judas Priest, or like I said, I've always got like Johnny Thunders and Elvis on my playlist.
Cool, man.
I identify with Johnny Thunders a lot, man. Like maybe it's because younger people probably, he probably doesn't mean anything to younger people, but I especially as I age, like I really relate to Thunders, man.
Wow, great. Well, you've been very generous with your time, and I thank you as always for coming on. I'd love to have you back on. It's always a pleasure.
No, I'm gonna be out of town for a few days this weekend, but yeah, hit me up next week, man, and we'll arrange something going forward.
I love it, man. I love it. This will be a podcast, so tell people how they can find you online, your Substack, stuff like that, and I'll make sure I plug that stuff. All right.
Yeah, man. you can, my website is kind of like my one-stop spot for like all the shit I do. It's thomas777.com, number seven, HMAS777.com. You can find me on Twitter at capital REAL underscore number seven, HMAS777. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Tgram. I'm on Substack, Real Thomas 777 at Substack.com. And yeah, that's where I'm at.
Cool, man. All right. Well, we'll be in touch in the next couple of weeks. And thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you, buddy.
Have a good one. All right. See ya. Bye-bye.
See you, man.
Yeah. Dude, that was awesome, man. that was awesome, dude. It's like I'm doing a podcast, but I'm also listening to a podcast. Going on like 15, 20 minute rants, chilling. Call me ignorant. Great times. That'll be a podcast. We'll get him on again. Have a good one. Well, thank you so much for watching the video. I really appreciate it, guys. If you want to support or follow my different contact links, you can go over to my new contact page. That's over at libertylinks.io/ignoramus. There are a couple technical difficulties with my last contact page, so I started a new one. Once again, that's libertylinks.io/ignoramus. You can find how to donate either by the month or a one-time donation, and you can see all the different places we stream and create content. There's Rumble, there's a couple YouTube channels, one for streams, one for videos. There's the podcast, Call Me Ignorant, and my social media, of course. We stream 10 a.m. Eastern time every weekday, a couple guests on every week, good interviews, good videos, good vibes out here. So please follow the content and join us, subscribe, tell your friends and things like that. And I will catch you in the next video.